Talk, Season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast. Coming at you, Tamara and Lily, the sisters with voices, better known as SWV. I get so weak in the knees, Evelyn, I can hardly speak. I lose all control and something takes over me. I can't explain why hosting this show makes me weak. I am Ryan Grant, screenwriter, lyricist, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Avrant, Banjacks, The Jump, and now The Breach, which is available currently on Kickstarter. Pop on over there and check it out. Some good sci-fi fun. The Other Voice in the Dark, The Man in the Box to the left this time is...
David Avalone, comics and TV writer, and very tired, unshaven show business veteran.
Ooh, wow. Yes, I'm often tired and very often unshaven. So welcome to the club. You are a more, I don't know, violent groomer than I am. So to hear you say that is alarming. I said you are a more vigilant groomer than I am. So to hear you express concern in that department is a little concerning to me.
I used to have very, when I was a younger man, I had very, very sexy 5 o'clock shadow. And now because the amount of gray in it, it goes from sexy to old Prospector Joe really, 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 really quick. There used to be a long Miami Vice period, but now the Miami Vice period is like a day. And then I'm Walter Houston in Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Gold! You know, it's not a great look. I'm just about there now. I'm just about
out.
Walter Houston o'clock over here on my face.
I'm too far off of that. I think I look pretty good for my age, and I think I look younger than I am in general. And that's if I'm shaven. The one place perhaps that I am apparently showing age is that I have some gray in my beard, so it grows in, and some like, how old is that guy? So I have to be careful. If you missed any of our previous conversations before we get too far away from it, episodes featured like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many, many more. Our entire catalog can be celebrated via YouTube, Apple Pods, and other purveyors of worthwhile ear cracks, so double on back and check it all out. We should probably get some promos in here before we bring our wonderful guest on, but what are you pushing up the hill this week, Evelyn?
Well, this week we got Drawing Blood number 6 should still be out there. The second part of our hero's sojourn in Hollywood, where the gritty reboot of his beloved billion-dollar children's franchise is being shot by director Morgan Harbor. We learned valuable lessons like Hollywood will break your heart and don't sleep with your fans. And Ned, that's issue 6 is out. October 16th or 22nd, depending on who you talk to, the first volume of the Drawing Blood trade paperback will drop, collecting the first 4 issues and the radically rearranged Ronin Ragdoll's origin story. Please do pick that up and bother your comic book shop about carrying it. You should even be able to find it in fine bookstores, I am assured, by Image. That's what I got going on, and there's plenty of episodes of Batwheels, which I write on, to enjoy with your kids and loved ones on Max or Netflix. And Ryland,
good stuff. I got to see
my movie out there.
I got to see my movie in the theater this week. That was pretty cool. I didn't know if any of us would ever get to see our movies in the theater unless we're writing Ghostbusters or whatever anymore. But yeah. My film's at Heart, which was directed by Academy Award-winning director Fernando Trueba, stars Matt Dillon and a lovely Spanish actress named Ida Fulch. That is in theaters now. It is available on VOD. But yeah, I walked into the Lemely in Santa Monica. Nice. And I walked into I got some popcorn, and I sat down in a very comfortable theater seat, and I watched the hell out of it. And man, it's great, And that's not even me tooting my own horn. I always think my scripts are pretty good, after I do 100 drafts on them. You've heard me say it. The film before this, I hated. Like I thought there were 100 things wrong with it, and I didn't want to promote. And despite some of the people involved, Emil Hirsch gave a great performance, and they're there are good things about it, but I'm very disappointed, and mostly disappointed because it could have been, it should have been a great movie, and it wasn't. Decidedly, Haunted Heart, this new movie, is just a really cool film. And Fernando Rueba directed this just kind of haunting and beautiful homage to Hitchcock and Patricia Highsmith. And you know, Matt's great, like he always is, but man, Ida Fulsch is just so lovely and wonderful. And she's given so much in every scene, you know, and just bringing so much to it that wasn't even there in the script, you know. Mm-hmm. And it grew out of the script, the soil of the script and all that. But man, I was moved. And you will be moved also, so go check it out. I'm very happy with it, so I'm a happy man. That's a big deal. At the same time, you know, the Breach, my new comic book, is available on Kickstarter. It is Black Mirror-esque sci-fi. You know, thinking man's, thinking woman's, thinking person's sci-fi. You know, in the vein of The Jump. But you're going to dig that too. So, hopping over to Kickstarter and check it out. We have a lot of friends too, that have stuff going on. So probably, I know Charlie Stickney launched today as we record this, but probably yes. A few days as you're listening to that, a new stanza of White Ash, which is, you know, one of our favorite books. And our friend Pat Shan has a couple of books, and Madeline Holly Rosing is about to launch, but Boston Metaphysical Society, you can probably hop mm-hmm. on over to her social medias and all that. Chris Longo, our friend, has his Panic Starter Pack still on Zoop. Steve Prince may still have Mr. Man going, one of my favorite books, so check that out. I'm sure there are a couple I'm missing too. What do you remember that I don't?
I mean, I'm sure Richard has started a new one.
Sure, he's probably got two going right now.
Fair Gray has always got a book out. I think the current one is the Ex-Wives of Frankenstein, number 4, which completes the series. That's one of those premises. There aren't a lot of them out there, but one of those premises I wish I'd thought of, which is Elizabeth Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein sort of teaming up when their exes, the monster and the doctor, become gay lovers who are very popular in the manosphere after they return from the Arctic together. So it's two women have nothing in common except their hatred for the men they used to be with, sort of ganging up on them. And it's a really fun book. But let us get to our...
Speaking of books that are worth reading, let's bring the
guest on. Adam Harry Rose, ladies and gentlemen.
Howdy.
Adam, how are you? Good to see you.
Always a pleasure, guys. Always love seeing you guys and love reading what you guys are up to. I got to admit to Ryland, Sunday I had a choice between Beetlejuice with my son and Haunted Heart. And I ended up with the Beetlejuice for now. But I promise.
What the fuck? Yeah, well, Tim Burton.
How old is your son? So. Is the first question.
I'm sorry. I'm excited to see that. It looks awesome, and I'm a diehard Matthew Dillon, Matt Dillon. You probably what does he go by? Matty.
Just Matt. As far as I know. Yeah. But who knows? Matt's gone through some changes recently. Matt lives in Italy now. He's a lovely Italian, partner, girlfriend. I don't know what you would call her, but he is European based, and so he is very cosmopolitan now, not necessarily the Matt Dillon that we grew up with, but a guy. I don't know. He's making a lot of interesting choices. Yeah. Here's the thing: is like he could take a lot of paychecks because he's Matt Dillon. Right? He could go the way of Al Pacino or whatever, right? But he's European based and he's and doesn't need money necessarily. You know, we could all use money, of course. Tim Burton, you know, is probably benefiting from that. You know, those movie tickets you bought. what I was going to say is, so Matt seems to be. You know, he waits. He's only working with directors that are kind of challenging and interesting, and you know, and he is reaching out to people. I mean, how he ended up in our film was because he loved Fernando. He loved his work, and at some point a few years back, he reached out to Fernando and said, "Hey, I love this film, and here's why I love this film." And they have this love of jazz and all that, and they got to talking, and said, "You know, look, you know, keep me in mind. I'd like to work with you sometime. And Fernando's like, actually, I have this thing. And Matt's like, oh, I love this. And yeah, so they figured it out. But that's where he is right now. And I think that that's, yeah, I think, you know, if we had, yeah, go ahead.
We all make lifestyle choices. And I think if someone like Matt Dillon stayed in the United States, he would have ended up with Michael Madsen's career. And I don't think he wanted Madsen's career. I don't think he wanted to play sexy psychos in a bunch of B movies that weren't very good. And, you know, decided sort of not do that. You know, there are, and look, he can probably live very well in Italy with his beautiful girlfriend. I mean, it's definitely a choice. We've all considered Italy, especially if you spend time in Italy. We've all considered Italy.
you know. I'd like to think that Matt would be a little bit better off than Michael Madsen for any number of reasons.
I mean, but you know, Madsen, remember who Madsen was after Pulp Fiction came out.
I think Michael Madsen was a hell of an actor. You know, never that leading man, though. You know what I'm saying? But I understand what you're saying. Michael Madsen's one of my favorites, with all his warts.
Yeah. So let's talk about the birth of Huge Detective and what the inspiration for the story was, and how does it end up at Titan, and how does it work at Titan?
The birth came, I mean, I've always been a big Roald Dahl fan, even of his non-kid fiction. Like his short stories for adults are super dark. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think I was reading something to my daughter at the time, like 4 years ago at this point. But I tell stories at night to them in bed, and I noticed we somehow were riffing on Giants. And then afterwards I got real dark on my own. Like, she didn't get the version that suddenly kind of clicked in my head. And then, kind of the main characters came to being first. And then the world building happened after I figured out who they were. And it kind of all just laid into place as far as, I'm not saying it was easy, but it was fun. I don't know. I just felt really invested in what was coming from, like, just the idea of these two types of beings, humans and Huge, and just what that would mean and the history between them, and how could I have that history be present in the present, like the wounds of that past as a big part of it. And then, you know, this later on finding, I mean, I actually had some early iteration, where this is hard for me, a hard learning lesson, that I think you guys were kind enough to kind of ask me to think about the whole process. And I don't know if I brought this up, but like I did very early on, I had somebody who did a couple pages, and they were, you know, the person, really nice artist, but something about it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had to be honest with myself. I was like, I got this. I'm not going to just say keep going here. So I like,
yeah, that's a hard one.
Yeah, so that was a challenge. And then Magenta King, I just saw his work in Jenny Zero, a Dark Horse. Okay. And you know, that's all about kaiju and whatnot, and just his use of perspective and point of view, and just all the scale and whatnot, and his style in general, I was just in love with. So I kind of reached out to him cold, and he looked over what I had cooking and immediately wanted to work on it with me. And then it really got built. Like, yes, I had the script and all, but with him, like, we like had, he lives in Brazil, and we just started like Zoom meeting every week, and just what we would add to it, like with our conversations, really helped build out everything.
And you then had written one script?
I wrote the whole five issues.
Before that, you brought in the artist.
Yeah.
You had written all five.
Yeah, I don't know. How do I put this? It was like, I couldn't stop myself. I don't know. Yeah. I was reaching out to Magenta. And then by the time everything was ready, he looked at everything, and that's where we clicked and connected.
And it was always going to be a comic book. You never thought of it as a novel or a TV show or anything else.
Oh no, no. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a thing. Like, that's a great question, because for me, like, I love this medium so much, and the elasticity of it. Mm-hmm. I wanted I kept saying yes to myself more than I've let myself maybe in the past, and how I was even writing for Magenta, it ended up being just wanting like the challenge of what you could only do in this, in a comic. Sure. So, yeah, no, it was written for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't, immediately detect the Roald Dahl influence. The obvious one was, Jonathan Swift.
Well, yes, of course. And I bring up, yeah. And I geeked out over that in high school, and, I always mispronounced the island, but I was fascinated by Brodenburg, where the giant, where, you know,
I don't know that I've ever even heard it said out loud. I've read it a million times, but I have not heard the word said out loud. Brodenburg, is that how it's pronounced?
Brodenburg, I think. Yeah. I, you know, thankfully the editors at Titan, because I spelled it maybe 10 different ways in my script, and they've like, no, it's, you got to just pick one. You can't
do this.
Yeah.
I think here's the thing, is I think it's actually not supposed to be pronounced. I think it's you're just supposed to say the island whose name cannot be pronounced. It's one of those things. Yeah.
Good. Swift. I truly like. I read that for school, but I loved it. I mean, it wasn't like just like a homework thing. Every one of the stories, like the Yahoos, you know, the intelligent horse people, and then like the genius. People are so limited to thinking just of like the Lilliputians, which is just one of like six stories in it.
I think that's just the most filmed part of it. Mm-hmm. So that's the part that people have seen. There's an animated film from the 30s or 40s, the Three Worlds of Gulliver. I think from the 40s, maybe the 50s. And I don't think the Island of Giants is in that one, but the part everyone remembers is the Lilliputians. That's the one of the three worlds of Gulliver that gets remembered. But it's interesting because, you know, both Dahl and Swift are satirists.
Yes.
And Swift, you know, famously, you know, a little less so in Gulliver than in his essays, just about as pitch black a soul as Roald Dahl, also suggesting that we you know, cure starvation in the British Isles by eating the Irish, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, that's you know, not a funny, not a funny kid book author
for
And it's always funny when these guys like Dahl and Swift become thought of as these kindly old men with James and the Giant Peach, and you know, it's like, no, Willy Wonka kills a lot of children.
Oh yeah.
Like there's a lot of child murder. Like they hand wave it a little bit in the movie, but I think I saw that movie the year it came out, and I might have been 6 or 7, and I just went, he's killing these children, right? Like what I'm seeing.
Children are so enslaved,
horribly maimed in one way or another, or just flat out murdered.
He's seemingly like enslaved an entire race of people also, and forced to drink candy. Like, you know what I'm saying? You know, I think we're soft on that when we see it in the movies and whatnot also. It is funny. I mean, it's like this exploration of these, you know, again, the great tales, how dark they got and how they have been cleaned up for us. You know, I mean, you see that all through literature. It's like, the lens got a little more rosy as history went on. I think that's interesting. And I think the sort of the crossroads of that. And we heard a lot of, this is how I came up with my idea stories on this podcast after 120 episodes or whatever.
Sure.
This might be the first time, I could be wrong about that, that it was like, well, I was telling my daughter a story before bed, and you know what I'm saying? That's a good thing. I mean, it is interesting.
The next comic I'm trying to launch is actually based on my father's bedtime stories to me, which were
nice.
You know,
that's great.
Fairy tales refashioned as World War II combat stories about himself, which, you know, was my father's original take on the material. And that should be cool. Fun stuff. Yeah, but how did you end up at Titan? Did you shop around a variety of places? Did you have an inn at Titan? What was the
No, was I mean I did. I was I mean, I was bringing it around to a few spots, and then but also I saw that Titan actually was dabbling in the like cuz it was Zoe Thorogood had an original on there, and also just I was already a reader of them because of Blade Runner, which I love. Like there are some of their IPs like are like fan favorites of mine since I was a kid, like Doctor Who, and then their recent deal with Jim Zub for Conan. So yeah, I know I just reached out to them cold with once everything was ready with Magenta, and that was the beginning of the conversation. And then they've been really great as far as like just really hands-on, and they loved bringing in these cool variants like Paul Pope for a cover, and Robert Hack and these other folks, and also just
I love Robert Hack. He's done a lot of covers for me.
Oh yeah, he's amazing. Yeah. So no, they've been like just great, and I got to meet a lot of them at San Diego. Like the timing almost was perfect, but they delayed issue one, so I was just there hanging out. And they like just
where are they headquartered?
England.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
So the way a con company delayed the release of something, that doesn't happen very often, does it?
Crazy if true. Yeah, I had not. I was looking at their catalog a little bit just to refresh myself before we started, and I had not realized that they had Conan currently. Last I looked, Marvel had Conan, and I didn't realize that
shifted in the last 2 years. Yeah, well, you don't remember that. I mean, friend of the show, Dave Pepo, was kind of a big deal where he was writing Savage Avengers and had Conan as part of the team. And I believe he had to cut Conan's tenure on the team short because there was a... there was a shifting of gears
whoever
manages the IP. Yeah.
Conan's got to be a minute and a half away from public domain status. I know all of his peers from around the same time are public domain status.
Interesting.
Red Sonja is a different thing because the version in the comics is barely based on Robert E. Howard. It's really something Roy Thomas created in the 70s. It's actually... one of my hobbies, because of having to write a lot of this stuff, is reading up on the copyright histories of things. And the Red Sonja one is fascinating because, you know, Roy Thomas changes her from a 14th century nun to Conan, but lady. And the Marvel version is the one that sticks. And then when the movie comes out and fails utterly... basically, a lawyer in LA buys the rights to that Red Sonja for a song. And that's the Lieberman family, and that's who ends up with it. And then they make the deal with Dynamite, which is why she's with Dynamite, you know, which is why.
Winnie the Pooh is a horror movie? Because Disney can't sue them?
Yes, because Winnie the Pooh went public domain last year.
But is that, can Disney still do things with Winnie the Pooh?
Well, once something is public domain, no one stops you from continuing to do, like, that means anyone can do it, but they can also do official things with it. Like, it happens every time they do something with a character they don't own. When they make The Little Mermaid, every animation company in the world made a variation of The Little Mermaid because they don't own the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale.
I have a naive question then, guys. I mean, does that mean that it's at a certain point Superman and Batman are going to be up for grabs?
About 20 years, 10, 15 years, something like that.
Does that mean we're going to see some like horrifying horror film?
Remember that the like Batman and Superman are 38 and 39, I think.
I can't imagine they're going to let that happen.
There's no not letting it happen. Like, they let it happen to Mickey Mouse, so it's going to happen.
It is a little reason, complicated. Go ahead.
Reason Disney bought Star Wars is because all of their legacy cartoon characters start to go public domain. And the reason they bought the Muppets, the reason Disney started acquiring things like Marvel and Star Wars is because their shit goes public domain way before the Fantastic Four, way before the X-Men, way before Captain America. So though Captain America is a bad example, he's the oldest one. He'll go, he will go public domain before Iron Man, who will go public domain before the Fantastic Four, who will go public domain before the X-Men. But they have plenty of money before we get there.
It is still a minefield because obviously Disney very, very litigious, obviously can outgun anyone. But so, you know, a little more simple with, let's say, Winnie the Pooh. If you go back to the original Winnie the Pooh stories,
which is not something Disney.
Something that only smells of and only references the original stories, you will be fine. However, doing that after, you know, decades of it being in the public consciousness is going to be very difficult. And if you make anything that touches on any iteration, shade, or color of anything that they have done with it since then you're going to get sued into oblivion, and literally they're going to go through it with like with a fine tooth comb and be like, when he uses this word in minute 16 of this thing, it is actually a reference to this thing that we did in 1982. You are now
paid. I have a question then. Now, I'm not trying to derail us into like some, this is like a lawyer's podcast. But
yeah, no, this is good
the
stuff.
The new absolute Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, are those a like year zero IP, like a, you, like rights wise? Is that
version of them? Sure.
So that might be part of what motivated that.
Yeah, I mean, every time you reboot, like Miles Morales, will become public domain 40 years after Peter Parker.
Yeah.
As an example, Spider-Man himself is public domain, like. You can do Spider-Man who's not Miles Morales or Peter Parker sooner than, you know.
That is,
that's still 100, that's 2070. You know, that's very far in the future. But yeah, my favorite thing, you know, one of my favorite variations of that is, you know, James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans has been public domain for a very long time. Michael Mann decides he wants to make a real true adaptation of James Fenimore Cooper. Go back to the source material. He goes back to the source material and goes, oh, it doesn't have the love story that was so great in the 1930s movie. So he has to buy the remake rights of the 1930s movie because he wants the love story with Cora that was created by two screenwriters in the 30s. So if you watch the end credits of that, it says based on James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans and the 1934 screenplay by, you know, oh, shit. My favorite part of the movie that I was looking forward to, like I imagine Michael Mann reading the book going, where the hell's Cora? What the hell, man? Yeah. Like, where's Cora in this thing? There's no Cora. Well, Cora was an invention of screenwriters and they made her, you know, the character that made you compelled to remake the movie. So oops. Sorry.
I feel like you all just helped me get my honorary copyright lawyer degree.
Especially if you work with public domain characters and you get like, but you know, a lot of it is also depending on, is there someone out there who cares, who thinks they can still make money on it? Like the first comic series I ever wrote, I dragged in very recently public domain characters, Kurtz from Heart of Darkness.
Wow.
Distinct from Colonel Walter E. Kurtz from Apocalypse Now.
Yep.
And the Emperor Jones from the Eugene O'Neill play. We're both like 1 year into public domain. Thing is, no one is out there going, counting that Eugene O'Neill money, going, well, wait a minute. Like, you know, someone put a character from the classic American theater in a comic book. Let's go after him.
Right.
To the degree that Joseph Conrad has an estate somewhere, I don't know that they're looking at Dynamite Comics real closely. Whereas... Zorro, Sherlock Holmes, and everything in Edgar Rice Burroughs, all that stuff is public domain, but there's a company called the Zorro Corporation that has trademarked guy with hat, mustache, domino mask, sword, and whip and cape. And if you use that combination of things, and what the notes I got from them that were so hilarious was like, Roy has drawn the hat 3 centimeters too small. Brim.
Yeah.
Our copyrighted Brim is the wider, like he has to draw the hat bigger, man, because that's our hat. He has to draw the cape a certain length because that's the copyright and cape that we're selling here. So it's a funny kind of, I know Lucasfilm gave Eastman a hard time because he had a Darth Vader cover where they were very concerned about the length of the beam of his lightsaber. Like, no, 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 man, that's too short for Darth Vader's lightsaber. And I was like, can the colorist fix that? Do you really need to redraw the thing for the, anyway?
There is a company, you know, strategy where, okay, let's say that, you know, let's say we're talking about Spider-Man and we all know the Spider-Man origin story, right? And so let's say at some point that lapses into public domain, right? So you can do this. You can tell the story about the guy that gets bit by the radioactive spider and blah, 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 blah. All said, how many times have we seen them do the Spider-Man origin story? It gets redone every couple of years.
Right.
And it is some variation, some take on the same thing. And so there is a legal strategy to this. Every time they do it, they muddy the water a little bit. And so, yeah, you and I could go back to the beginning at some point and tell our own story or to the letter we tell the original story. However, if you start to infringe and step on something that 10 years ago or 20 years ago or whatever, and it feels a little bit too much like that, or you by accident end up with the same tale that they had 17 years ago in a comic book iteration, you are then open to, you know, and it can get pretty complicated, them trying to prove that you actually stole this from us and all of that stuff. But it could cost you a couple of $100,000 to defend yourself in that case, right?
And you know,
and they will outgun you because they want to they want to obliterate that no one else tries this. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So so proceed with caution. You know, go ahead.
And you get the wrong judge. I mean, I think that.
Yeah. We're talking about the wrong judge. I love it.
James Cameron is a serial plagiarist, but I would say that the one he got sued for and lost, the Terminator, like he got a judge that did not understand science fiction tropes. You know what I mean? That had never seen a time travel movie in his life. So he didn't know, like, well, that's not really from Harlan Ellison. That's like in 1,000 time travel movies. But Harlan won the case because he got a judge that was not very science fiction literate. And Cameron had to add Ellison's name to the end credits. And also Cameron had done the dumbest thing you can possibly do, which is in interviews he had said, well, I was very influenced by Harlan Ellison's two short stories, The Demon with the Glass Hand and Soldier. Which, you know what? Don't do that.
Yeah, thanks, bro. Give me some money.
the Coen brothers decided to be smart about it. They did a note-for-note version of The Glass Key. And in interviews, they said, oh, well, we mashed up elements from Red Harvest and The Glass Key. Not really.
What movie is that?
That's Miller's Crossing.
Oh, wow.
But it's really just The Glass Key, guys. But by saying, oh, it mashes up elements from... The Hammett estate let it slide, you know, whereas Walter Hill owned the remake rights or owned the film rights to Red Harvest for decades. He lost them at one point. When he finally got the money together to make the movie, Kurosawa's Yojimbo is an uncredited variation of Red Harvest. The remake rights to Yojimbo were cheaper than the literary rights to Red Harvest. So he bought the remake rights to Yojimbo. And if you watch Last Man Standing, it says based on Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo. He could have also bought the remake rights of Fistful of Dollars from Sergio Leone.
Yeah.
Also an uncredited remake of Red Harvest. So it is a tangle, man. And you know, it's always been that way. The King Kong rights, if you're ever bored, go to Wikipedia and read the copyright history of King Kong.
Wow. Because
it is the most labyrinthine. It's cut into different slices. The current MonsterVerse movies, the Monarch movies, they own the slice of King Kong rights in which King Kong is as tall as Godzilla, which were sold to Toho in the 1960s to make King Kong versus Godzilla. But in 1933, King Kong, he's 25 feet tall. He's a third the size of Godzilla. Right. Those are separate rights. Universal owns those rights. And, you know, whoever's making the Monarch movies owns the tall King. It's nuts. They failed to copyright the novelization of King Kong. So virtually everything in the 1933 King Kong is unprotected.
Wow.
So that's you can actually do whatever you, but Kong himself is trademarked. So it's all, that's why he's often Kong and not King Kong. It's crazy.
I feel like we haven't seen a lot of King Kong in comic books.
There have been Monarch spinoffs in some comic books.
There's been a lot of Godzilla.
Yes, there's a lot of Godzilla. People love
Godzilla. Marvel's had like a whole series. Like he's not even in them. It's just like he's on the cover of an Avengers. He's on the cover of like an X-Men.
Well, he fought the Avengers recently. He fought the Power Rangers.
Right.
You can always drag Godzilla out. I did a satire version in Elvira called Kingzilla, and I actually looked up Godzilla King of the Monsters number one from Marvel from the 70s so that I could get the spelling of that sound effect right. And oh, it's nice. Spelled like S-K-E-O-G-G. It's crazy. And of course, Elvira looks at the sound effect and says, I always wondered how you spelled that. Because I really always wondered how the hell you spelled whatever that sound is. But the history of all that is fascinating. And if you know, it's one thing if you do entirely original works, but if you toil in the fields of licensing, it's always kind of fascinating. And for example, I had not realized until I recently reread it, the Godzilla that Marvel did was in the Marvel universe.
Oh, okay.
The first issue has Nick Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. Like, that Godzilla shares the world with Captain America and Iron Man, and I think that's just like, what does Dr. Doom do when Godzilla comes to Latvia?
Well, I would assume Mole Man might be like his uncle.
Yeah, it's just, I love the way Marvel kind of did that with most properties. They pissed on him a little bit. The Micronauts exist in the Marvel universe. Like, everything is ours.
I've been loving, I got it. Well, I only have the first issue. I don't know if there's a second, but that Avengers Aliens, I love it. I love that it takes place in a dystopic or post-apocalyptic, I should say, future where everything's been ravaged by the aliens.
But it's in the Marvel universe.
Yeah. Well, that's but funny. In the future.
Right. I remember reading, I always remember being kind of shocked at how much you could get away with in comic books because no one was watching. When Chris Claremont introduced the Brood in the X-Men, I was just kind of like, dude, seriously? this is just the aliens from Alien. Like, their heads are a little different, but everything about them is the same. The storyline is the same.
But how would you quantify in that same decade, well, 90s, Starship Troopers? That's based on a novel, like science fiction series of novels, right?
Yeah, that's based on a novel.
A novel, okay.
By Robert Heinlein. And a much imitated novel. And I can tell you that, you know, speaking of our friend James Cameron, I dated a colonial marine from Aliens, the redhead who gets killed first. And I mentioned that it kind of reminded me of Starship Troopers. And she said, oh, James had us all read Starship Troopers when we were training for it. And he said, this is the movie we're making. We're making Starship Troopers.
Wow.
And I was like, he's got to stop saying shit like that to people. Like, you know, he's lucky the Heinlein estate never met you.
Well, now he doesn't have to worry about, like, I don't think anyone's going to try to imitate unobtainium.
Yeah, no, probably not. I think he's
so terrible.
Avatar. Well, so and actually, unobtainium is from some other science fiction novel. I can't remember.
It's horrible. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't he have access to the most brilliant writers on the planet? And that's
originally it was stupidium, but they didn't like that. So I was just trying to read up on the really interesting story with the Dick Tracy rights. Do you know this story?
I've been reading him again because my dad loves him.
The Warren Beatty thing is hilarious.
Yeah, so Warren Beatty, you know, he controls the rights to the film and TV rights for Dick Tracy, as long as every couple of years he produces some content as Dick Tracy. And so he would from time to time he would like basically like purchase time on public access, and they would do some Dick Tracy special where he's just sitting in front of a camera in like a public access TV station dressed as Dick Tracy reading some lines. And they would usually kind of turn it into like a retrospective, like, hey, let's talk about Dick Tracy, and let's, you know,
the last one was on Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah. It was more of a production than some of them, but some of them are like, he's rolling into public access at 1 a.m. in a fucking Dick Tracy costume.
It's the greatest, it's the pettiest thing in the history of mankind. He doesn't want anyone to make a Dick Tracy movie while he's alive. So every 5 years he puts on a yellow trench coat and a hat and points a camera at himself and talks for a half hour. And they're literally, they have to be called sequels.
Wow.
It is a sequel to Dick Tracy, him talking to
Dick Ben Tracy Mankiewicz. Six.
Yeah, Ben Mankiewicz, him talking to Ben Mankiewicz on Turner Classic Movie for a half hour is the sixth sequel to Dick Tracy. And in the last one, I believe he mostly complained about how Warren Beatty was too old to play Dick Tracy. Warren Beatty should give it up and stop playing Dick Tracy. That was the meta content of the last one.
I wouldn't
be opposed, though, to like an old man Logan style Dick Tracy.
I like that first movie, and I think someone should give him money to make an old Dick Tracy movie. I think that would be, because you know, if you do the Indiana Jones logic, his current age would be like Dick Tracy in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, Dick Tracy going after Son of Sam in Manhattan in the late 70s, in the gritty, horrible Manhattan of the 70s. Because I think Dick was in, I don't know that we ever identified the city Dick was in, but it was either New York or Chicago.
I forget its name. Because I've been reading the series. Because like my dad, I just send him, I read him and then I send him to him because he doesn't know how to find a comic book store.
Sure. But, the Alex Segura ones that are coming out now?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're great. I love Alex. I think he's very talented.
Yeah, they're fun. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't know, this part of me, because of the movie from the night, like the Beatty movie, I like how it's grounded, but there's part of me that secretly wants more of that just color pop of just the distinct, exaggerated characters.
Yeah. That's the problem I'm having with The Penguin. While it's a perfectly good crime show, there's zero Bill Finger surrealism in it. I just need a little hint that it takes place in Gotham City, not in New York City. A little, there's not enough crazy.
Yeah.
It just needs a little more.
Right now it's the Sopranos.
Yeah. It's literally just the Sopranos with an Irish guy in a fat suit for no reason that I can. it's fun that you wanted to do this, I guess, but I don't, you know, though I heard the showrunner came to him and said, you want to do a season two? And he's like, if I have to see that fucking head again, I'm going to kill myself. So I don't think he's ready for season two just yet. But for doing the comic book shows that aren't comic book shows and that run away from the idea of comic bookness, that has haunted adaptations for a really long time. And it's one of my favorite things about the X-Men 97 one. Is that was like, this is just reminds me of reading X-Men comics 20 years ago. It has that real feeling of reading comic books. And you don't actually get that a lot.
A
lot of running away.
But when we're seeing like with Transformers in comics, the Thundercats, G.I. Joe, like they're like topping the sales charts like bananas. And I mean, they have amazing artists and writers and whatever, and the stories are fun, like, and there's the nostalgia, but my hope is that it's just not guys our age reading them, that it is like bringing in young readers.
I can say, you know, writing the Elvira comics, I look at the fan reactions on Instagram and on Twitter and whatever, and I generally see women, which is encouraging to me, but I also generally see people who are definitely too young to have seen like Elvira, Mistress of the Dark in a movie theater. So I don't know where the hell they discovered her. I don't know if they discovered her through Knott's Berry Farm or Knott's Scary Farm. I don't know if they just discovered her in the air of pop culture. You know, I know she's done movie hosting shows more recently than the 80s. Obviously, she's been doing stuff on and off. But like that has persisted in a crazy way where it's still popular. It's still out there. She still sells a comic book.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she was on the
young to have known who she was.
Yeah, you know? She was on the last Dick Tracy special, I think. A lot of people saw her because of that.
Yeah, because those run up the big numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I was surprised that I had not heard the Dick Tracy thing until about a year ago. The last one he did, I think, because it was on Dick Turner Classic Movies, someone said to me, "Do you know he's been doing this for 40 years, you know, 30 years?" Because Dick Tracy was 1990, 1991. So it's 34 years ago now.
That's a commitment.
That is, no, talk about commitment to the bit, man. God bless him. Could you imagine, you know, Connery showing up on your local cable news in a tuxedo every 10 years going like, "I refuse to let anyone ever play James Bond again." You know, and it is fun. There is an interesting thing. I remember in the 90s finding out, and this is long past, there was a period when Richard Anderson, Oscar Goldman, owned the rights to the Bionic Man and the $6 million Man and the Bionic Woman. And he would periodically go to movie studios and pitch them and say, "Look, you can replace Lee Majors and Lindsay Wagner, but I got to play Oscar Goldman in this thing, or I got to take a big payday." And it's always amazing to me, no one took him up on it. No one made a $6 million man movie in the 90s with aging Oscar Goldman. But to me, that's a savvy, you know, that's a savvy businessman. Like at some point when the shows were canceled, it clearly must have been at the moment the shows were canceled and he was sitting on his paychecks from starring on two TV shows at the same time. And he went, "Let me just scoop this up." You know, and I'm sure whoever owns the rights now paid him or his children a fair amount of money to own those rights. I'm always impressed by people who know how to not run out of money in show business. You know, it's very easy. Used to be my favorite thing back when the LA Times had a real estate section. Let's say our young star's name is Joe Smith. Joe Smith stars in a new TV show. It's a hit show. Three episodes have aired. Joe Smith buys $8 million house in the Hollywood Hills. I'm like, "Oh, Joe, man, no, not three episodes in. Anything can happen, Joe." You know, I have a friend who was, you know, one of the top four stars on a TV show for a decade. She bought a house 4 years in. Like after making whatever it was, $60,000, $60,000 a week, 20 weeks a year for 4 years, she finally went, "Now I can reach into a pocket and pull out an enormous amount of money and not worry about meeting a mortgage when this show goes off the air." You know, not a lot of people do not have the brain. A lot of people have the, "This is going to last forever" attitude.
Yeah. It does be a Vincent Gallo of Buffalo 66 fame and Brown Bunny infamy. Made a couple of dollars at the beginning of his career, you know, had this Sundance darling and, you know, use that heat to, you know, end up in a couple of pictures here, a couple of pictures there. And he hoarded all his money, he kept it. And at the right time, he bought a bunch of downtown real estate. And so now a lot of people don't know this. Vincent Gallo is like absurdly rich. So some people are like, "Well, why doesn't Vincent Gallo work more?" And there are any number of reasons why Vincent Gallo doesn't work more. He's a dick. He talks. People don't want to come within 100 feet of him. He made Brown Bunny. There's all that. But also, he has more money than probably any 50 or 60 people that I know very well put together. And he doesn't have to. Sinking into real estate. It's a good use of your money.
or a vineyard. I mean, Megalopolis was funded entirely with wine money.
Yeah. $120 million.
Yeah.
I heard someone, I think Audrey Plaza said it might be the most, or Howard Stern interviewing her said this might be the most expensive indie movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, prior to that, it would be Phantom Menace.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Because okay. Phantom Menace was also George Lucas reaching into a pocket and going,
I didn't know that.
Star Wars money to make a Star Wars.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
And I will say, so when we found out we were having, you know, our baby 8 years ago, we had this one bedroom apartment, needed more space. We looked at the real estate market, rentals were out of control. We were going to end up paying, you know, $3,000 a month 8 years ago to live in some cornhole in the valley, that we hated. The prices of homes, of actual real estate, were not out of whack yet. And so we're looking at it and we're like, oh, wow, like we can get that, you know, in terms of a mortgage payment. And of course, putting a down payment on anything is quite the thing. And I had to rob out of dealers to get the down payment. But once we did that, we were locked into this much lower mortgage payment. We owned our home. And so 8 years ago we bought, and since then our home has appreciated about 125%.
Right.
In like 8 years. So again, if you can do it, particularly in Los Angeles, and in Los Angeles it's more difficult to do than anywhere else. But yeah, real estate can be a way to go. So So you know, there are any number of states in the union where my home is my retirement plan is a really bad idea. In Los Angeles, not so much. I could sell my very tiny home right now for way too much money. I could go to, let's say, move to Ann Arbor, like a wonderful place to live, and buy a much larger house, and you know, have a good chunk of change to feel secure with. A little of a financial planning advice from your Uncle Riley. So.
Yeah. Look, it's you know, it's part and parcel of why we fight for residuals and royalties and whatever. Passive income. I always say that, you know, when children play Monopoly, you need to say to them, you're being taught a very valuable lesson about capitalism here. If you can't make money while doing nothing, you're screwed. Literally, passive income is the entire game. And if you have nothing that makes passive income, you work every day of your life, and hope you like that.
When you earn money, you better take that money.
Yeah.
And put it to work so it makes you more money. Otherwise, you're not going to have any money. and that is this weird.
The financial plan.
Cycle, right? Yeah. Otherwise,
That's also why the word property is in intellectual property. Because it's property, the idea is that you sell it and it is valuable, and you know, it is eternally valuable if you're lucky, you know.
Exactly. And it is the difference between working for someone else and working for yourself. And it was this I've talked about it a lot, my shift to my IP business model, where it was like, well, I spent a lot of years writing scripts for other people, or just writing a script and outright selling it to people. And that's fine. You make a good chunk of change, but when it doesn't get made, it dies on their shelf, it dies on a hard drive, it dies wherever. You only get paid once for it. Well, when I started generating IP, intellectual property that is mine, it was a different story. I have short stories that I have sold 3 times, and they will pay me to option them. And then they will write the movie. And if they don't make the movie in a year or 2 years or whatever the negotiated time period is, then the intellectual property comes back to me, and I can go and option it again and get paid to write it again. And again, there's some interesting legal things where it's like, well, second one can't be quite like the first because they still own the script from the first one, maybe. But however, it's worked out pretty fine for me, and it has been a lot better deal for me owning and controlling the IP. Also, it's like I sort of have some say, right? It's like normally, again, you're we have to talk to the Zorro people because they have the IP and they have some say in it, blah 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 blah. And it's like, well, they have just optioned the IP from me, right? And so they ultimately, if they want to actually make the thing, they have to execute a purchase from me, which means I have to be happy. And of course, I mean, I want the thing made, so I'm not going to hold up too much. But if they fuck with me, I can fuck with them. It gives me a lot more power. And normally, as the writer, I am the person with the least amount of power. But when I control the property, also, that puts me in a the rules are different. And sometimes they're not that much different. But even an extra inch, right, can buy you a lot of breathing room. So
yeah, it's funny how I have a property currently under option. The option is up in December, and I'm just kind of like, I talked to my partner about it. I was like, do we remind them or do we surprise them in December and remind them then that they don't own it anymore and they owe us X amount of dollars if they want to go on owning it, and meanwhile we sell it to someone else. It's kind of interesting when like the worst case scenario is them re-upping the option, and the best case scenario is us selling it for something more somewhere else.
And talk about some income.
The point here is own things.
Own things. Yeah. That is the best news ever when it's like, you know, because shit takes forever. I mean, Haunted Heart just got made, and I've told this story on here before. It took 16 years for Haunted Heart to get made, right? Wow. And the number of times where, you know, you sign a big deal and it's like, well, you know, it's obviously going to be on a movie screen and, you know, somewhere in a year, and then 5 years go by, right? That sucks in any case. What makes it a little bit easier is when your manager calls you and says, a year is up, as of yesterday, and they just sent you another check for $20,000. if they do this again next year, it's $35,000. And if you have a good lawyer, or a good agent, that's how it gets negotiated, you know? Yeah. So again, there is a lot that sucks about this business and about this job and all these things. And I don't want to complain too much because you're paid to make up stories, right? So it's not that bad. It beats working. However, you can, when something takes 16 years to get made, when it's got everything going for it, that can be a little hard to handle. But what makes it a little bit easier is, with Haunted Heart, it was like, well, 16 years ago, they paid to do everything, and then it almost made, and it didn't for various reasons that I've covered on here before. But then, you know, whatever, 14 years go by, and they're like, hey, we want to make this. And I'm like, well, you got to pay me for all this stuff again.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And so essentially, you know, it was like, it sucked that I had to wait 16 years for this movie I love to get made, and it would have helped me a bunch, you know, years ago and all that. But a good consolation prize is, well, you know, at least I got paid twice. So that's good, you know. Control the property. And that was a situation where it was like, well, my deal was with one company. And it was a second company that was kind of picking it up, and you had all these people interested, and the train was moving, and they couldn't make the movie without me. I had to sign over all of the stuff to it. So in a way, I controlled the property, and it wasn't that I completely controlled the property, but the property could not switch hands without me signing off on it. And so in a way. And of course, I had every reason to want the property to switch hands and all that stuff. However,
you might reasonably think, as a reasonable person with a reasonable brain, well, surely no one would give you $20,000 for a movie they had no intention of making relatively soon. Surely no one would pay $300,000 for a movie they weren't going to make.
Yeah.
Don't you kid yourself. There's a lot of money out there that is dumb. And that doesn't know what it's doing. Yeah. And the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. Yeah. I have been in so many situations. I cannot tell you how many times I have had a movie held up that I was working on in one way or another. And someone said, oh, we found out we don't own the script. And I'm like, how did you not know that you had not paid? Well, we paid the guy an option. We forgot that we then owed him this amount that's 10 times that usually. To actually buy the script from him. Like we had a handshake, but he actually never signed the contract selling us the script.
Oh boy.
And now we are supposed to shoot tomorrow. And now he wants $500,000 because we are shooting tomorrow. And and then they talk it down to something between the $200,000 and the $500,000. But that is a relatively common experience of executives and producers not realizing they don't on paper own a thing that they think they own.
Right.
Shockingly common.
Yeah, I had a Japanese company bring me some tokusatsu properties. Hey, we have all of these, and here's the paperwork on these, and you know, we would like you to help us kind of exploit these in Hollywood, right? And so I took a bunch of meetings, and I was pushing this and pushing that. We cut a sizzle reel together on a TV thing for one of them, and at some point. It was a really good company that had a deal at FX when like a deal at FX was gold, minting money. And they're like, we love this thing. Let's call your lawyer. We're going to pay you to do a pilot. We're going to do all these things. And I went back to the company and I'm like, hey, you remember what you asked me to do? Well, here's the fucking deal of a lifetime on it. Like, I didn't think I was going to get something this good. Like they want to do a pilot right now, you know, and it's not like, oh, let's sign the deal and wait around and lollygag. It's like they're looking for something. They want to go now.
Right.
So get me this paperwork. Get me this. Get me that. And the reaction is, oh, shit. And I'm like, what do you know, shit? Well, you know, we thought we had this, but we were looking into it. And it's like we only have this. It was one of those things where it's like, give us a week.
Yeah.
And we're going to get you what you need, you know? And it's like, okay. And then I have to go back, like looking like an idiot to the FX people and be like, well, we need a week, just give us a week. And then a week goes by and they don't have it yet. And another week goes by and they don't have it yet. And you know, the Japanese company is like, oh wait, there's something here. Like, can we get more? Is there another company that wants it? Is there And so basically the Japanese company, they were not pot committed yet. As pot committed as everyone thought they were, and they used the FX deal to get another big deal somewhere else. It was not as good a deal in terms of like what they would end up with, but dollars and cents in the moment.
Right.
I think that's all they were looking to sell some widgets. They got a bunch of money up front, and it got turned into something garbage in like Korea or something instead. Because they could say like, oh yeah, this big American company, this big American wants it. So, and that's how the shit works. Like, oh, well, we want that, you know, wait, FX wants that. No, we want it. What do we got to pay you? You know? And they would come back and be like, what is FX going to pay us? And it's like, well, they're not going to pay you anything now. They're going to pay to make a pilot and you have a stake in this TV show that's going to run on this amazing network. And when the TV show gets made, you get a lot more money than that. And it's like, oh yeah, but they're going to give us this small bag of money right now. We want that small bag of money. Like we can't spend promises from FX. And, and it's amazing how often that happens. It's scary and terrifying. And but there's a lot of good stuff that does not get made because of this shit.
Right. There's a lot of incompetence. What is it? Never put down to malice what can be explained by incompetence, because incompetence is really the thing that runs the entropy runs the universe, not anger. But yeah, I want to plug in back to Huge Detective one more time. How many issues is there? You said five issues were written.
Five issues total. Issue three is middle of November. It's coming out.
Okay.
It's been like a great first go of the first two issues. It's been nice seeing people like it and respond to it. And Magenta, like I said, he's like furiously working on the final stuff. And
great.
I'll be signing at LA Comic Con Sunday at Golden Apple's booth, Sunday 10 to 1.
Nice. I think this episode is going to run after LA Comic Con.
All right.
we can talk about how great that signing was.
Time machine, you can go back to
because this episode is for the second Wednesday in October.
That makes sense.
Excuse me. People can pick up Huge Detective at their local comic shop, or is it available?
Yeah. That's, I mean, you know, tell your comic shop you want it ahead of time, I suppose, just in case they don't order it. And, but yeah, they can get it any, at any local comic shop. They can get issues 1 and 2 still, and tell them you want the whole kit and caboodle.
And where can people find you online?
I'm proud to say I finally have a website. I'm adamharryrose.com.
Ooh, wow.
And then on here, yeah, Instagram, I'm Shazam Cap. I don't know why I came up with that. And on that place called X, I am adamrose74.
Great.
Wow.
And Ryland, where can the kids find you online?
Yeah. Well, on Instagram, I am actually Adam Rose. Why he had to go to Zam Cap. Yeah. So I'm you know, again, control the IP. I'm waiting on Adam to pay me for the handle. He has not met my price yet. But someday. I am actually I also own at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. That's where I do most of my messaging. That is RYLENDGRANT. If you were just listening, most of you are. I always have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it, and so now I have to spell it for you. You'll find all my business there. As I said before, my film Haunted Heart is in theaters right now, and it is great and it is wonderful. And so go see it. You can also catch it on VOD, Amazon Play, Apple TV, all of that good stuff. Awesome. Really beautiful cinematography. You are rewarded for going to the theater on this one. It is shot on a Greek island that is absolutely gorgeous. And seeing that on a huge screen just does something. It also has a this beautiful score by this fella who did the music for the Colors trilogy and the Decalogue, and so, you know, again, being in a theater with Dolby sound and really letting that music rock you is pretty wonderful. So go in the theater and see it if you can. Also, my book, The Breach, it is a sci-fi joint, Black Mirror-esque, that is still running on Kickstarter right now, so go check that out. Go give us a lift. It is a rough go on Kickstarter right now. A lot of projects, and you know, people. It seems like across the board, everything's down about 30%. So, so huge help if you get on there, and you know, go digital if you have to. Here's the thing: we talk about this a little bit. We've talked about it a lot. Is that getting on? And even pledging a dollar makes a big difference to a creator that you like. You don't break the bank. What it does is every backer, every supporter, every little tick up on the website kind of supercharges the algorithm, and the projects that are getting work, that are getting more engagement, more involved, those are promoted more internally. So even if you pop on and you pledge a dollar, that might mean that it gets put in front of 20, 30, 100 more people on the website. And so your $1 contribution could mean a couple of $1,000s for that creator, for the Richard Grays of the world and whatnot. So get on there, support people. You can support me, of course, but we're talking about Richard Fairgray. We're talking about Steven Monsignor. We're talking about Holly Rosing and Boston Metaphysical Society, Charlie Stickney and White Ash, Pat Shane and all his great cheeky comics books, and you know, I'm probably missing 100 great projects right now. But get on there, some algorithms for some people. That's your homework assignment for this week. So go do it. Bring us on home, Avalone. You are muted, my friend.
I am muted because I was taking cold medicine, which is not a thing.
Ooh. He was muted because he was furiously firing up algorithms on Kickstarter, and yes. and the sound of the keys going crazy was going to drive us all bonkers. So
no, I was using my friend's throat soothe from Woodstock Herbal Products. There's a rare commercial for you. But yeah, I can be easily found at davidavalonifreelance.com, which branches off to all of the various social meds, as the kids say, and I have Drawing Blood in stores. Headed for issue 12, kids, so jump on and stay on. It's good stuff. I would like to say, love it or hate it, there is nothing else like it in comics right now. It's a very, very personal story while also being a highly fictionalized autobiography. It's a look inside show business in general and comic books in particular, and the life of a legendary creator of comics, co-created by me and a legendary creator of comics, Kevin Eastman, who created the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Perhaps you have heard of them. And that's it. So Drawing Blood, Drawing Blood, Drawing Blood. That's what I got going on. Writing on Batwheels for season 3. Season 2 currently popping off on various streaming services. I got at least one or two episodes out right now that you can look at. And that's it. Enjoy, and thank you for joining us. Thank you, Adam, for joining us on this episode.
Thank you, guys. I love talking to you.
Of the right block. It's great having you.
Huge detective.
Thanks.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.